This is the Andres Segovia Show.
Welcome to the Andres Segovia Show. I am Andres. I'm a first-generation American, born and raised in Los Angeles, and I am an admirer of what you do and those like you do. So my screen just went blank here on my other tablet, so I had some guides for to make sure I hit all the thoughts I like to approach. But you, as we talked about just before we got rolling, so to speak, you're well known mostly now basically for outing yourself to in a way set the record straight with a couple of other your colleagues. I know them best as their nicknames, Tanto and Tig, to set the record straight about what went down in Benghazi, Libya. And as I told you, that's been spoken ad nauseum, so anybody that's interested in checking that stuff out, I've already spoken about this in the pre-recorded intro, but just in case, the book 13 Hours by Mitchell Zuckoff, or the film of Michael Bay, people can look into that. But with respects to exactly who you are and your band of brothers there, for the audience who's never heard of GRS, can you explain to them what exactly that is?
Yeah. So in the private security world, or private security contractor world, you have basically two different types of contractors. You have those that are industrial contractors. So a lot of people have heard about them. There are those that work for companies like Blackwater or Hart or Dynacor, things like that, or companies like that. They're contracting, they're subcontractors to that company which has the contract. And then there are the direct hires is what we call them. And that means that I was a contractor as a direct hire with the Central Intelligence Agency. I also like to call it the Culinary Institute of America, but it is, we're direct hires to them. And I'm a contractor directly with the US government. And we work for a group called GRS, which is Global Response Staff. And our job is to be bodyguards for our country's spies, basically.
Now, I don't know if you're able to answer this question, but why would the government hire private security for basically publicly funded security agencies of the government? Don't we have plenty of armed forces? Why would they hire someone in private? I don't know if you know that answer or you've been asked that, but I am curious why.
The biggest reason is all of us have, extensive military background, and for being a private contractor, private security contractor, I think a lot of it has to do with ease of deploying us to wherever they need us. As a contractor that's a direct hire, I can go anywhere that they want me to in the world. If I'm using an industrial contractor, they have to have a contract with that area that they're going to be working in. If it's military, it's a completely separate branch of service, because that's Department of Defense, which has its own chain of command, where when you're with either State Department or any of those groups, then it's going to be that you have some, that you're working directly for them. And it's a whole different pay scale, all of those different things.
Okay. And I guess in summary, from the political standpoint, is that it cuts to a lot of red tape, it sounds.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Okay. So that's, as someone that is a small business owner, I know what it means to have insurance to operate as an independent contractor, which is something that I've heard you touch on one of your interviews, or it might've been a documentary even. For example, you're in California, which is pretty much, if you're a small business owner, you're working mostly to pay insurances off. We got general liability insurance. We have to have workman's compensation insurance. We have a bond on top of that too. And sometimes you need a bond for a bond. And if that's not enough, there are particularly, that's not even counting the automotive insurance that is needed for those of us that have vehicles and we have equipment and so on and so forth. In other words, a lot of insurance. I imagine as independent contractors, you guys need to have your own insurance of sorts. Can you speak to that? What insurances are basically required?
If you can, or if you have a pre-existing life insurance policy, you can have that. Or a pre-existing health insurance that will cover you when that type of job description, which most of them don't. And because of that, the federal government has years ago, back in, I think, World War II, established, it's called the Defense Base Act, or it's a law that was requires that private security or private contractors that work for the U.S. government have to have a workman's comp policy at a minimum. And that's pretty much what most of us have. And that's it, is a workman's comp policy.
No, as someone that actually has to renew a workman's comp every single year, we have a lot of competition for our workman's compensation insurance. I imagine there aren't that many options for what you do.
No, it has to be gone. I mean, because the what we do is also classified. And there's only one group usually that has that contract to provide that. So you have to go through the one that they tell you you go through.
Wow, that sounds like a monopoly, and they control the prices. Oh man.
Yeah, it's very interesting because, I mean, not only do you have your workman's comp policy, and now the benefit for us is we have to pay it up front, but then do in our contract, the government reimburses us for that workman's comp.
Okay.
But then also with that is underneath that, there's a, what they call a war hazards clause. So if there's any of your injuries are obtained in a act of war or anything that would replicate an act of war, the federal government pays back the insurance company 115% of all the money that they spend on taking care of you or fixing you up or all of that. So it's kind of like they get to double dip.
Yeah, that's really what it sounds like. It almost sounds like they would interest them for you to be in those situations.
Yeah, because, you know, it's interesting because, like, all of my injuries, and I don't know, I've heard this only, so I don't know for a fact if this is completely factual, but my understanding is that, you know, insurance companies are good at projecting costs that they're going to spend to take care of somebody based on injuries and life expectancy and things like that. So they, my understanding is that they bill the federal government up front after they determine what your injuries are for all of that. And they come up with that number that, you know, Mark Geist got injured at the age of 40, he's going to live to be 75 or 76 is the average life expectancy. We will pay him roughly $5,100 a month for the next every, you know, it's basically $60,000 a year from the age of 40 to the age of 76. So they come up with that number, they give that back, they bill that to the federal government, then they get their 15% tacked on top of that. And it just seems like it's a big money-making money. I mean, it is what it is. And I mean, I go into it knowing that, or at least most of the guys do to some degree, but I just think it's, there's better ways to do it, I think.
Yeah. And that touches on a lot. I've actually dealt with government contracts as well. And there's, you can pad these things a lot, and that explains why even in Congress, pork barrel, just a lot of pork that's added onto these bills. We go, you can. It's not a subject I'm going to get into this conversation, but what California is doing right now in terms of trying to alleviate housing because they want to address homelessness. It's the gross mismanagement, talking about a surplus while they're saying that we have record debt. That doesn't make any sense. That doesn't mean we have a surplus, but they're looking, instead of paying down debts, they're looking for new ways to spend it. And they keep trying things that don't work in the name of helping those they've been trying to help. The programs have only exacerbated the problems. I'm actually going to talk about that in an upcoming episode for that very thing, particularly because it's in the area of what I do. No, there's a reason I'm going down this kind of line of making people understand of this GRS world and where you come from, because I don't know if I mentioned it while we were now recording, but basically the Benghazi terrorist attack is something that it exposed or at least brought to awareness to GRS. I first started learning about them around when Black Rifle Coffee started taking off. I really respect those guys, despite some of the political fires that have been happening recently. There's outrage culture everywhere. I'm not addressing that. But listening to Matt Best tell his side of the story, every time he came back from a tour, he basically couldn't assimilate to civilian life, and he just wanted to go back out there. And even your colleague Tonto, just hearing him talk, even reminiscing, every time they bring this up, he's like, I want to go back out there. It's like, oh. And on Instagram, it looks like he's getting ready to go back out there. Like he is keeping in shape. So it's like, oh, this dude is serious. With respects to people like that serve and don't stop serving. I believe there is a point where it's like, okay, you maxed out here. You can't serve any more tours. Either choose to be a career military guy going up the ranks of general, whatever, or contracting. Normally, when people think about this, they probably think, oh, mercenary or guns for hire. And I think that's too broad. I would reserve that for more of the guerrilla warfare in my Hispanic country south of the border. But with respects to a little more personal, why did you get into contracting?
I spent 12 years in the Marine Corps. I got out. I was in law enforcement for about a little bit over 6 years. Worked crimes against children as a deputy for a local county sheriff. And then I was chief of police in a small town. And I just, when the war kicked off, it was just a way to get back into serving my country and serving the people of this country. And that was the easiest route to do it. And get one is the best gain for me, or the best use of my skills. And it also afforded me a better way to make a decent living. Now the downside, is going into the contracting world is you don't have, you got to provide everything. You don't have the family support services. You don't have, the insurance, any of that stuff. And you go into it understanding that, and like you said, I mean, the difference between contractors and mercenaries is contractors are doing jobs where it's not offensive action. There is at no time did we go out seeking to go, doing like a direct action mission or going in doing something where we're going to go, which would be offensive, or doing a infantry or special forces kind of action. What we did was protect people. That was our job, was to provide protection for others. And if they got shot at, then we had the right to defend ourselves and defend them. Mm-hmm. But never at any time did we want to, and we worked in small groups. So at no time do you ever want to get into a gunfight anyways. I mean, our idea, my idea of security is not being seen, not being heard, and staying below the radar.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. Seriously, I'm honored that there are people like you out there, because God knows we need more. So it's in the case of, as I brought up Matt Best from Black Rifle Coffee, to him, he could not assimilate. And his drive was to feel that adrenaline rush, I guess you would. Those that have served would know what that means. So he kept going to contract. I don't know how many contracts he ended up doing, but then when he came back and was basically forced into civilian life, so to speak, that's how Black Rifle Coffee really came about with he and his partner, Evan. So that worked out fantastic, because then their mission to employ 10,000 veterans, so, well, they have more power to them. I'm excited for that. But that's just it, that after the first Persian Gulf War, PTSD became something that people were more aware of. People didn't really understand that. And now that's even something that's in the NFL to some extent with the concussions. You knew about it but didn't do something about it. So now what now to those that suffered from it or suffer different things? There's a lot that isn't really being addressed, and people just want to either throw more money at it with services that don't address the root cause. Instead, they're just trying to treat the symptoms, for which is why it's I don't think that problem's going to get solved just like that, because they're not getting to the heart of the issue, which is something that I guess we'll get into in a bit. You had mentioned something with respects to injuries. And this kind of goes along why I was building up to this, because I didn't catch it the first time. There's some captions at the end of the film 15 hours. I'm like, wait a minute, did I read that right? So I'm going to touch on that. But I have a very close family friend trying to get the mail out of his mailbox at the front of his house. And he lives by himself. And as he was going over to get it, there was a planter that was he had that uprooted. So that was basically a ditch. And I don't know how this might have happened, but unfortunately, he tripped and fell and landed on both of his forearms, basically breaking. So he could not reach out for help. All he could do be there screaming by himself. So the process that it has been for him to even get back to get some functions of his hand has been quite a journey to just even be able to write his name, because he loves writing checks. One of those old school types. So that was quite something to basically see and involve him, because he and my father are very close friends. That my father was with him for a lot of that recovery journey. Some might not be aware of your injury. Can you let my audience know of what injury you sustained during that infamous day?
Well, the most visible one was I start this off with the fact that I was left-handed, but my left arm, piece of shrapnel went through it, disintegrated 2 inches of the radial bone, 2 inches of the median nerve, shattered the ulna, and basically a piece of skin here and a piece of skin and a little bit of meat down here was all that was holding it on. Wow. It was pretty much, if you've seen them, anybody out there of your viewers who have seen the movie, they did a great job of making it look real. Yeah. In the movie. But so that was my major, that was probably the major injury that was visible. But the other one they showed kind of in the movie was I got lacerated on my neck. Mm. I had some shrapnel get my neck, and it was, as my wife says, because when my wife first saw me, or when I first talked to her, she asked if I was okay. And I says, yeah, I broke my arm and I got a few scratches. Mm. When she saw me in the hospital, she's like, well, your arm seems to be okay, but it looks like they about took your head off too.
Oh man.
But totally, I had another roughly about 20 to 25 holes in me from shrapnel, 4 or 5 pieces in the chest, up and down both arms and legs, along here in my eyes. The only thing that saved my sight probably was I had night vision goggles on. So, the movie did a good job depicting the major ones, but there was a bunch of other minor ones too that came along with that.
Yeah. And that tends to be what, there's only so much that can be said or shown or even understood in a film. That's why I can't tell you how many times I've seen that movie. And every time I pick up a different nuance, which is to tells me that Michael Bay really did his job in research. I don't know if you were among those that were brought onto the set before they started filming when they recreated the compound. I know Tanta was there, but they're like, whoa, this is like pretty legit. I actually showed some pictures of both the set and the actual attack, and I showed my wife and friends, like, tell me which one is the film and which one is the real thing. They're like, whoa, that was attention to detail considering how quickly the director moved. But I don't want to get sidetracked with the film, because I'm a big film junkie, and this is probably my favorite military movie of all. But with respect to that, the reason it's important is because at the end of the film, it talks about you being re-enlisted to be treated for your wounds. Because yes. Again, as someone, as a small business owner, there's been accidents even during the course of work. It's construction, so it happens. These things are very, very expensive. And in some cases, or not some, but most cases, workman's comp is there to try to find out how not to pay for the injuries. And in your situation, knowing what happened to my friend that I consider an uncle, and how hard it was for him to come back from that, and he hasn't entirely fully come back from that, I can't imagine how expensive that must have been. And you just talked about how many more holes you said you got in. Yeah, can we talk about it? This was the small rockets fire, which I'm assuming was an RPG, or was it the motor, or or a combination of both?
Mainly the mortars. The RPG hit the wall out in front of us. Luckily, the bad guys weren't very good shooters, and most of the rounds hit either went past us or below us. But what really got me was the mortars, and there was three of them that landed on the rooftop, and they were 81 millimeter mortars. And this gives you an idea of, wow. So an 81 millimeter mortar is about 3.5 inches in diameter, and has a kill radius of 132 feet, which means that if you're within 132 feet, you have about a 98-99% chance of dying. This is where I know that, you know, the Lord was watching over me, had his protection on me that night, because I was within 15 to 17 feet of three of them. So there's really no reason I should have lived. I mean, I should have died three times that night on the rooftop alone. And for whatever reason, the blast went through me and actually killed Ty, who was standing on the opposite side of me. For why that happened, I have no answer other than it's God's purpose. And who am I to question him?
Yeah. And as a fellow brother in Christ, I can tell you that this is that purpose. You started something here, the Shadow Warriors Project, that brings attention to all this. I've taken time to address what basically no one's talked about. They only like to talk about the event itself and the politics thereof and this and that. That's not what interests me. It's what interests me is that this just highlights things that there are those that do this and nobody knows about them. There really isn't much available to them in terms of recourse or resources, or even benefits, so to speak, to tend to them, especially when all the attention, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but a lot of attention when we do speak of our veterans, we think mostly of those that served publicly, if you will. And a lot of the charities and organizations are meant for that. Now, I guess I got to give a trigger warning for some people here. I did not know this. This is actually something I saw last night. Donald Trump Jr. was actually bringing awareness to also bring up some kind of fundraiser for the organization as well. You mentioned that you both are friends, which I think is pretty awesome. I imagine that was because you guys met on the campaign trail, but it's not something I want to dive into, but I am bringing it up because there's more big voices need to lend more to this. Yeah. Compared to him, I'm a small fry, but for those that know me, I will not stop talking about your organization. I heard when it was brought up, like, yeah, finally somebody. So there is your answer for why you walked out of there, that you're the first. And we are going to, I don't know how much time I have with you, but I do want to get to what the Shadow Warriors is now doing and the K-9 project and all that. But with it's the serious injury, I'm assuming that's why you were re-enlisted, so to speak, so they can try to cover the expenses thereof.
Yes, and the other part of it was because, unfortunately, it got turned into a political football that was getting tossed back and forth. And the amount of publicity that it was getting, because what they did is, the easiest way to explain it to people on the movie where they would understand it is that I got re-enlisted. What really was is I had the Department of Defense, the director of the Department of Defense gave me authorization to utilize military facilities to get my life-saving injuries, which are my major injuries, taken care of. And that was, you know, because they had the expertise at Walter Reed to take care of my arm and some of my other injuries, where a civilian hospital, as good as they are, they don't have as much experience in blast injuries as they did in Walter Reed. The number one hand surgeon in the Army was the guy that treated me, and he was phenomenal. But that's kind of what explained. That was just the easier way of explaining what the DOD directive was that allowed me to have access to the military care system, at least for that purpose.
Yeah, and that's why I'm like, when I saw that recently, like about a week ago since we're recording this, I'm like, hold on, I need to know what that means. It's because I've been in the political arena of ideas for about 18 years. And before the politics, I was involved in a lot of doctrine and theological debates. I'm born and raised a Christian, didn't make me a Christian, but when I accepted Christ as my personal savior, I still wasn't entirely sure what I was doing. I got baptized at 16, but I didn't start living for him until I was perhaps almost 18. And that's someone coming from dealing with a lot of depression. I'm a suicide survivor. I attempted 5 times. And I'm like, God, why won't you let me die? Satan won't let me live. So all that is to say that he said he has a purpose for me. And like, I'll go with it. I didn't want to live, but you're saying there's a purpose for me. Fine, I'll yield over to you. And so like, I guess there's a reason for it. I mean, I didn't ask to be born, but all right, I'm here now. So that's kind of where I was brought up. I'm not even entirely sure where I went on that segue, but there it is. So I actually never talked about this on my show. So here I am opening up a little more, I guess, because this is, I guess you could say, this has been entirely personal to me in a way. Both 9/11 attacks. This is the one that really is washed under because of, they say, most people still think it's a YouTube video. Ridiculous. And I think that's why I take it personally. It's like, no, and it's because of that people like you are not taking as seriously. And like, no, they need to be taken seriously. I mean, I was saving this question for the end, but I think the way we're building up to this, I think it segues nicely. People don't understand individuals like yourself, mm-hmm. that put others above themselves. And you were not at the annex when this stuff started going down. The film tells it in one way, but the point is you were offsite.
Yep.
But I imagine had you been on site, you would have left with your brothers to the villa.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Right. If I had been out in town by myself without the female case officer, I mean, my job is to make sure she survives and get her back to safety. Had I been out there by myself, I'd have just went straight over to take care of what needed to be taken care of over at the consulate. And it's really what it is about a lot of us that are in the military. It's serving that something bigger in ourselves. And I get into debates with people a lot about personal service or selfishness versus selfless service. Mm. And that selfless service is, our service is to the Constitution. And that Constitution allows people to disagree with me. And I support that Constitution that allows us to have a difference of opinion, to have all those rights. Even if I disagree with somebody, I'm willing to sacrifice and die for that, for them to have the same rights as me and every other American out there. And I think that's sometimes where it's lost and why a lot of people get offended that are in the military, because people don't understand why they serve. And that service is something bigger than ourselves. It's to the people of this country to make sure that we have the freedoms that we have. And, being Memorial Day and all of that, I mean, it's all of those who have died that have gone before us to make sure that exists.
Yeah. And it's sad how, a lot of people don't even know why there's a Memorial Day. I actually pre-recorded the intro to this, it was getting close to press time, as they say. And it's like, you know what? We pushed the schedule around a little bit, but I'm still going to pre-shoot. I shot it like almost 2 weeks ago. The intro, and I talk about how I think it was a PragerU video that I saw, a man on the street interviews. Why do we have a Memorial Day? Why do we have a Memorial Day? And a lot of people think it's kind of like July 4th. Oh, it's just I guess something to do with Independence Day, like, it's got nothing to do with it. And it's like, wow, really? If anything, I guess you could say there's 2 days set aside to remember our veterans. One, because Armistice Day, there'll never be another great war again 20 years later. And it's like, oh, yeah, that didn't last long. It's called human nature. we're designed to just be at each other's throats. Turning into Veterans Day, before I became like a video platform, I was doing podcasts. I would do a ceremonial thing where like, hey, thank a vet. But lately, these past couple of years, like, you know what, we need more to remember the fallen to, and not enough is being done for that. And like I had said at the onset, there is this theme of forgotten that it's very well driven in the film, like, to really hit hard. And the soundtrack by Lauren Balfe is just absolutely amazing, particularly because the uncut song is about 9.5 minutes long. And he took a lot of, this is me getting into the compositional stuff. He took a lot of cues from his teacher, Hans Zimmer, who did A Thin Red Line, also a great soundtrack, and called Journey to the Line. So it builds, it crescendos into this emotional like impact. And in the film, when I, because I heard the soundtrack before the film, I was actually one of those that was turned off by the reviews. That's why I didn't see the film. And that's how political that whole thing became. It's like, oh, Michael Bay did a movie, so, you know, it's not a good movie. You don't have to go see that. It's not a good movie. And like, and I bought into that until coworkers of mine told me that they couldn't stop crying. It's like, okay, what's going on here? Crying like Bruce Willis done at the end of Armageddon, kind of crying? What are we talking about? Because of Michael Bay film. So, but I had heard the soundtrack. So hearing in the context of it, and they did in the scene that they used the music, is the moment where the CIA worker, the gal, she's making phone calls to try to get some kind of help to the annex. Like, look, under attack, we're alone here. At least just send some jets. And the shot is in silence. The jets are on the tarmac. They're not going anywhere. It's that theme of forgotten that continues to be like something it's kind of like a dark cloud over all this. And it's almost like political people want this to be swept away, because if they bring attention to your organization, they have to bring attention to the incident that in of it itself is a political football. It's like, why can't we just see what happened? And the politics be damned. There are Americans that needed help. We didn't help them. And if it wasn't for 6 guys on the ground that literally were protecting and serving people that they don't know, for the most part, it's amazing. And that, I guess, that kind of leads to this question, because I had built it up. Had you been at the annex when it all went down, you would have gone, you're in enemy territory. Mm-hmm. You can't tell friend from foe. And like you said, you're trying to keep a low profile. What the heck would drive somebody to go through all that hostile terrain to get to a place that you don't know how many people are there? You can hear the mortar, probably the rocket propelled grenades, the small arms fire at this place. You can hear the screams over the radio. Why would you, undermanned, try to go there to save people you don't know? What kind of mindset is that?
You know, it's that selfless service. It being a part of something bigger than, I mean, it's making a difference in somebody else's life. I mean, in a kind of another way of looking at it, it's like seeing somebody who falls down or is in a car wreck and driving by, or that person that stops. Which one do you want to be? You know, I'm in a hurry to get to work, or do I want to stop and help this person? And I'm just that kind of person that would stop and help. It's just what's been ingrained in me from childhood. You know, I grew up, my hero was my grandfather. He served in World War II. He was a tank commander. Wow. He was in North Africa. He was in, the push across Germany, had 5 Purple Hearts, wow, a Silver Star, a Bronze Star. I mean, I had 3 uncles that served in the military. So that sense of being a part of something bigger than yourself and actually making a difference in other people's lives, for whatever reason, just resonates with who I am. If you look at everything I've done, I got out, I became a law enforcement officer because I got to serve other people. I worked crimes against children because I wanted to serve those that couldn't protect themselves. And I went back into contracting because I wanted to help those who couldn't help themselves, or at least make it easier for them to help themselves. And to put a moniker or a name on, I don't know what it is. It's just who I am.
And that's really awesome. Because it's not something you get to think about. You just do.
Yeah.
And to touch on the movie a little bit again, because that's probably the only way people are ever going to really find out more about it. Pick up a book, people, read books. It's more detailed. There's only so much you could put into a movie. But you use the analogy of a car wreck and you pulling over to help somebody because within your nature. I guess the difference in the situation that happened September 11th, 2012 was if you pull over and help that person that got that is in that car wreck, you will be fine probably, but mostly you'll be fired from your job, and that business will make sure to tell everyone within that industry that you are not allowed to work in that industry ever again. That's something that's really it is mentioned in passing in the film. John Krasinski's James Bagdell and John Krasinski exchanging the dialogue, say goodbye to contracting work, but you can't put a price with living with yourself. That's something that's missed entirely here, in right. that it's not just helping somebody that was in a car wreck. You're literally giving everything to go help them. And that's something that you and your brothers were not thinking of. It's like, we got to help them. Let's go.
And that's exactly it. I mean, we knew that they were always undermanned over there. We knew that their level of experience was not as great as ours as a team, their team versus ours. I mean, together, if you put the six of us and all of our service to the country together, it's over 100 years of service.
Wow.
Where you put those guys at the State Department security team, total service would probably less than 30 years, you know, and most of ours was, of our guys, it was all on the higher end of the special ops community. It was a lot of combat related type experience. And I think part of that made the difference is, you know, we knew that they would have difficulties and defending themselves. And when they came over, their team leader came over the radio and he said, if you don't get here now, we're going to all die. And there was a few expletives in there as well, but you could, you know, when I'm driving back with the female case officer, I had my radio on, I could hear it as well. And I heard that, and you could hear the fear in their voice, and you could hear the fact that they were going to, I mean, they would most likely die had we not gone over there. And, our guys were willing to go over there in spite of that. And I don't know how anybody could be any different than, you know, somebody's hanging off a cliff and you stand back because you're afraid of heights, or you reach down and grab them and save them.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't think there's any way other to live life other than to be a part of something bigger. And I think that's part of, that's my Christian heritage and, the foundation that I have in that as well. I mean, somebody asked me early on was, were you afraid of dying? And I'm like, why would I be afraid of dying? And they're like, well, you'd be dead. And I'm like, one of two things was going to happen that night. I was either going to live and come home and be with my family, which is phenomenal, or I was going to die and go home and be with the Lord, which is phenomenal. So tell me where the downside is to any of it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just the way I approach that kind of thing. That's the way I approach life is, I would rather make a difference in people's lives than not.
Yeah, it's Tonto that Chris, he's the one that has on, I saw it in a news clipping once, the main hallway entering his house, he has the verse, greater love has no man than this to lay his life down for another. So like, yeah, coming from him, it means a lot. Because he was talking about his brothers that laid down their lives. So it's, we do need more of that. And it's along those lines, having said all this, for why your purpose, as I see it, because you're doing God's work, has been creating the Shadow Warriors Project with your wife, Crystal, right? You both did this. And it's to honor those that served like you, because to remove this, like I brought up mercenaries because people think guns for hire, adrenaline junkies and all that. No, that's not what these guys are. Don't paint them with a broad brush. That's it's prejudice, really, when we look at it that way. So that's why I wanted to take the time for you to basically dive into that and explain your mindset, because then that really drives home the purpose behind Shadow Warriors Project, to help those that served and suffered like you did, and those that continue in silence. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us one of the big things that's been going on was the last year you guys got the K9 project, so but now that's like really expanding. Can you touch on that for those that are not aware?
Yeah, so you know, I was blessed with a group that gave me a service dog. It's a Belgian Malinois, and where they come from is a group, is a breeding group up in Canada called Baden Canine, B-A-D-E-N. It's Baden Canine. They've been breeding and raising the shepherd breeds, which are German shepherds, Dutch shepherds, and German shepherds for 50 years now, roughly. And since I was blessed with receiving my dog and the difference that it made in my life, in a lot of aspects that it took me a while to realize, I wanted to share that. Me and my wife wanted to be able to share that with other contractors, private security contractors, and other veterans, because there's a special connection that we have with dogs, especially dogs. I mean, animals in general, but you know, most people don't think of it like this, but dogs are the only animal that will leave their own kind to come be with us. There is a special connection that we have with dogs. I think that, me personally, I think that their dogs were put on this earth by the Lord, by God, to be our companions. I don't believe that they're descendants of the wolf, and I know that goes against science, but, you know, it's tell me a wolf that will leave its own kind to come be with us. They don't. And there's a certain, I call it a vibration, that we share with this animal, and they help us heal emotionally, physically. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that they provide as a service dog, as a canine service dog. And so we wanted to share that with other veterans, since we were blessed with that. And from that, we can only breed enough dogs, especially the high-end dogs like this, that Roan is, and we can only do, you know, give away maybe 10, 15 dogs a year at best. Mm-hmm. So we decided to expand it one step further. Is, you know, I grew up farming and ranching and around animals and horses. Since I've gotten injured, and, you know, I've been aware of a lot of equine therapy programs, where they're pairing PSD individuals that have PSD to, or PTS, I mean, that have PTS with equines, with horses. Mm. Well, we decided to do the same thing with canines, and we call it a canine therapy program, where we bring in 10 combat vets, anywhere between 8 to 10. We introduce them to the Lord. We don't proselytize. I'm not going to force you to do whatever. I think we're going to plant the seed and love on you and let the Lord work it, do his work. But introduce you to the Lord, introduce you to the dog, and through the dogs, through these canines, teach you how to manage your anxiety and your stress, because those dogs are great at helping us with that. And then the third leg in the tripod is to get everyone to tell their story. I mean, all of us, not just your combat story, but your life story, because so many of us that join the military, a lot of times we're either running from something or to something, or a combination of the two. And we show up in the military with a bucket already half full of trauma, because, you know, we're single parents, or we, you know, had no parents, or we were abused physically, sexually, emotionally, whatever the case may be. And if you don't empty that bucket, sometimes it gets full. And if it does, that's when it comes out and affects us and those that we love so much. And so we really try to do that peer-to-peer support and peer-to-peer counseling by bringing guys and gals together that have served in combat, that can understand one another, and do it in a small enough group where it's intimate enough where they're not afraid to share. Mm-hmm. but it's not so small that it's too intimate, and we've just seen great things come of it. And it's just phenomenal, because this way we can run one of these at least once a month, and that's over 100 people that we can do, that we can help every year. And it's the follow-on work that comes with it, because these small groups end up sticking together and communicating and staying in touch with each other as things grow and as their walk grows, both within the group with the dogs and with the Lord. And it's phenomenal what we see from it.
Yeah, and that's why I'd hold on to the belief that there is such thing as a doggy heaven, because I'm looking forward to seeing my dog again. It's like, if not, that's like the only thing that could challenge my faith in God. I unfortunately had a part ways with my dog. Lived quite a long time, but it wasn't his time just yet. It's just an unfortunate accident when a friend with a vehicle was came near my dog. So we had to make a decision, and everybody turned to me and says, "Hey, so we're gonna leave the choice up to you." It's like I held that puppy when the mom pushed it out. That was hard. And I buried him. I was like, "No, I'm gonna bury him in my house." And my brother felt for me. It's like, "Hey, here's a dog for you." It's like, "No, that's not how it works, man. I build a bond. You can't just bring me a dog that that you chose for me and say this is for me." But here's the in between was interesting. Months before my dog passed, there was a litter of kittens that were born in the rose bushes, and I'm shocked that two of them decided to stay behind, and they bonded with my dog. So now that my dog's gone, I'm not a cat lover at all. If anybody knows me, I hate cats. If anything, they're the ones that it's like, there was a joke that I saw yesterday, reminded me of it. Two dogs and a cat, they go before the Lord, and God, they go over each dog. I think one was a Labrador and the other one was a German Shepherd. And they started going through every personality trait that these dogs have. And God said, "Okay, you sit to my left, you sit to my right." And then the cat, what are you here for? And the cat's like, "I believe you're in my seat," says the cat. I'm like, that's the thing. That's what cats do. It's like, what do you do all day? So it's like, I'm only here when I want something. So that's been my thing against cats. But this cat, every time I see him, because he finds me, he looks for me. He's an outdoor cat. And it's been just over 2 years now. I'm like, why, when I see you, do I just think about my dogs? It's the only cat that's that calls to me, knows where I am, follows me wherever, knows what time I come home from work. He's there. It's like, "Hey, you're home. I need to be fed too, but hey, you're home from work." So it's something that bond with animals, as you mentioned, is important and key. Something that my dad talked to me about when he was growing up in El Salvador. He and his dog, 5, 6, 7 years old, just sitting out there in the cornfields, looking over the stuff, you know, just him and his dog looking up at the stars and all that. So yeah, it is amazing. And thank you so much for your time. So I'm going to leave it for one last question here, because for those that are interested, they can go to www.shadowwarriorsproject.org to learn more and how, you know, they can help with the effort to, like as your organization does, help those that suffer in silence. This is more of an all-encompassing thing where the polarized world that we live in today, and hearing a story like yours where actual violence versus words are violence, how, and the trauma that you've also sustained with all this that's happened, and how often if this is brought up, it's become like, let's talk about the politics of it, and like, oh, again. And how do you shut out all that noise? How do you just put it all, like, I gotta do what I gotta do? How do you do that? Is there any advice that you can give to those that in their own field of work or lives, that there's a lot of noise constantly, and they just gotta like set their mind to focus on what they gotta do?
You know, the first thing I do is I stay away from social media relatively, or I shouldn't say I stay away from it. I limit my exposure to it. Mm. And same with the news is, you know, it's, we look to the news. I like watching local news and stuff that's very pertinent to, you know, our immediate lives. And I think the other outlook I have is I look to both from politics as well as, I don't look to Washington, D.C. to solve my problems.
Mm. Yeah.
I can't figure out what problems they've really solved ever. And that's not the left or the right. That's just anything within the Beltway. How often have they solved the problem? And if they have, it's not many times, and most of the times they make problems bigger. And their whole idea, I think, is to keep us separated. They want me and you to disagree because of our ethnicity or our sexuality or our, you know, our gender or whatever, instead of, you know, because no matter what our differences are, we have far more similarities to each other as a human race than anything. And if we would focus as much time on those similarities as we do getting distracted with the differences, and I think that's the work of the devil anyways. It's fear and hate, and he wants me and you to fear and hate each other, because if we do, then he can exercise his authority over us. Where if we love one another for being people, for being mankind, no matter what the differences are, and again, I go back to, I can disagree with somebody and still love them. Yeah. I can love them as a human being and forgive them for whatever. And I hope people are able to do the same with me, because by far do I walk. I mean, I make mistakes all the time in my life. It's giving a crap about each other.
Yeah.
And not let that outside noise. And if we focus on that love for one another, instead of all that white noise or whatever you want to call it, that's trying to get us to hate and fear each other. Life is so much easier. Life is so much easier and so much better.
Yeah, definitely. And it's on that note that we'll leave it here with the interview. Mark Ozgeist, I still can't believe I'm actually speaking with you. it's an honor and a pleasure to have had you here on the Andres Segovia Show. Thank you so much for your time.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. You have a wonderful day. It was great talking.
Yeah, likewise, sir. And God bless you, your wife, and your entire organization. I help what I can when I can, and I'm going to keep doing so.
Well, thank you. Again, thank you so much for your support and all your listeners. God bless y'all. You know, find a cause, get behind it, and be a part of something bigger than yourself. Amen. Whether that's us or somebody else.
Amen to that. If you'd like to learn more how you can help, please go to www.shadowwarriorsproject.org. And by all means, share this episode with everybody you know, so they too can get learned on this and hopefully be moved to also help those that have done so much for us. Thank you, and I'll see you in the next one.